This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a sociologist who studies partner violence highlights some concerns she has coming out of the high-profile defamation trial wrapping up this week that actor Johnny Depp brought against his ex-wife, Amber Heard. Now, 1 million people in the U.S. have died from COVID-19. That's according to numbers out last week from the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. It's a number that can be hard to wrap our heads around. And after hearing stories about the growing death toll for more than 2 years now, it's easy to become numb to the level of pain and grief caused by the pandemic. Our next guest studies mass trauma and how communities and countries collectively remember it. He's with us today to talk about making sense of great loss. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel overwhelmed? Is it hard for you to comprehend fully how many people have died in this pandemic? If so, you are definitely not alone. Have you or someone you know lost a loved one? What has grieving during the pandemic been like for you? If you lost someone, whether it was because of COVID-19 or another cause. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Eric Boynton is a philosopher and edited the book Trauma and Transcendence, Suffering and the Limits of Theory. He's provost and dean of Beloit College. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm glad to be here.
It can be, of course, tough to cope with the loss of one loved one. A million deaths, a huge number. How do we start to wrap our minds around that?
Right. I mean, this is an age-old problem. The difficulty of coming to terms with a single death. I mean, a single death can be incalculable in certain ways, but death on a mass scale that affects an entire population, and in this case, as it has in the past, affects the whole world, is a scale that is difficult to find the modes by which to calculate or capture the kind of loss. And so the feeling, the recognition of this loss is one of just overwhelm, of inability, recognizing that the powers or abilities we have to take stock of what has just happened always come up short. And it's that recognition of inability that has to be paid attention to, I think, in the very first instance of trying to grasp what essentially comes across as ungraspable. That might be a start at the answering that kind of question.
Are there things we can do as communities, as society, I don't know, at the government level to memorialize, to do things ritually or symbolically to help us cope and understand this?
Right. So there's been some interesting movements around in memory studies, collective memory studies and memorialization, really since the first half of the last century, after the atrocities of the First and Second World Wars. Memorialization is often about a country or a nation reckoning with its past and setting its course for its future. And so a lot of memorialization over the past centuries has been about large stony obelisks, large monuments that talk about overcoming odds or talk about victories or talk about ways of gathering together a nation and pointing towards a different kind of future. And this is always about moments of inauguration. So a nation rallies around some kind of event that then opens up what it means to be a citizen of that nation. In this case, we're finding over the last 80 years or so, there's been a shift in memorialization around recognizing the inability to talk about victories, to memorialize in stony kind of positive ways what has just happened. So one quick example of this, of course, is the 9/11 memorial in New York City with the reflecting pools that essentially are reflections of absence. So the loss of buildings, the absence of buildings, the footprint where the buildings once stood now become a waterfall that flows down into this dark abyss. And so it's actually using absence as a way of memorializing what happened on 9/11. And that technique has been around now for a number of decades, and it's being used more and more as a way of, again, thinking about what has happened in 9/11 or thinking about what happened the atrocities in World War II as a way of setting a course for a nation going forward, not by something positive, but by a counter monument, by a monument that also reflects where civilization went awry, where we find such a deep and a profound loss that there's nothing that can fill in that gap. And so the only thing left to do is to memorialize it as loss, as gap, as inability to truly fathom. So the 9/11 memorials are one of those things, but also memorials for the murdered Jews of Europe in the heart of Berlin is another example of that. And the recent memorial in Birmingham, Alabama, to the numerous lynching victims in the South is another reflection of this kind of memorialization that still attempts to chart a path forward for a nation, but not by men on horses, but through other means. Rob, does that kind of make sense?
Yeah. We're talking to philosopher Eric Boynton from Beloit College, provost and dean there, looking at how we cope or comprehend the scale of loss from something like COVID-19. As the U.S. just passed 1 million deaths last week, you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Eric, I wonder if there's something about the way this all proceeded, the deaths, as opposed to a horrific but very public event like a 9/11 or a hurricane or natural disaster. So much of the suffering and death happened in emergency rooms, in homes, where we weren't confronted with it, didn't witness it in the moment or day to day. Does that affect how we process it, how we understand the scale of it?
Yeah, Rob, I think that's a great question. I do think there's a difference. Hitting 1 million deaths over 2 years due to pandemic, I think, is very different than commemorating loss due to horrific tragedy, warfare, those kinds of events. Even 9/11, which, you know, the planes hit and within a few hours the buildings fell. So that really is an event that you can place a day upon. But the pandemic is a slow burn. And there's something about living through this moment for so many months and spreading this 1 million deaths over so many months that has, I think, it's a different way of taking stock. There's a way in which the dramatic kind of loss is now felt as a malaise, as an underlying anxiety about the future versus a momentary flash that makes you think or question the future. Now there's this ongoing task to negotiate the world in the midst of pandemic, in the midst of loss, in the midst of continuing loss, that is very different than a one-time kind of event that maybe we could memorialize in other ways. So I do think sometimes after atrocities, you know, the future is dark. The future is not open for me to step into. In this situation, I'm constantly moving into the future in the midst of a pandemic. But I think there's a way in which we're moving into the future, negotiating ongoing anxiety, ongoing threat, ongoing malice, the world kind of pressing in on us in ways that is different this time. I don't know, Rob, does that make sense to you?
Sure. And now you've also talked elsewhere about the role of misinformation and why someone might seek it out or be at least approachable for it. Can you tell us how that comes into play with your thoughts on the pandemic?
Right. So I think if you look back in history, the ways in which we as humans writ large, dealing with these kinds of mass events of suffering and atrocity and loss, there is always attempts to try to grasp this thing, to try to put it into contained, give it some kind of parameter so that I can talk about what just happened. And there's ways in which thinking about drilling down on, put it this way, calculating the loss is one attempt to begin to take stock of what has just happened due to the pandemic. So, running numbers, a million versus 500,000, we could still have this this our conversation if it was a million or a million five. The numbers aren't really important in this sense of the loss overwhelming us. But we also have this desire to take stock, to control, to think about how it is we might have done things differently, how we might do things differently in the future, how I can organize my life presently right now to gain control of this thing. And my idea, and I don't know if it's if I can defend this all the way down, but my idea is that the belief in misinformation is one way of gaining control of that which feels overwhelming. So it's the attempt to not even pay attention to the pandemic as pandemic. It's a way of taking stock of calculating the pandemic by not paying attention to it. And so I think it's far from belief in misinformation is far from turning your back on the pandemic. I think it's actually facing the pandemic, and it's a way or a technique or a mechanism by which to deal with what it is that we're all facing.
We're talking to Eric.
In that regard, go ahead, Rob.
We're talking to Eric Boynton, philosopher and provost and dean of Beloit College, with us today to help us think about what it means for the U.S. to lose a million people to COVID-19. We crossed that milestone last week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has it been hard for you to wrap your mind around how many people have been lost in this pandemic? How do you think we should commemorate locally, nationally, within families, people lost over this time? How do you think we'll remember this in future generations? And a few moments ago, I said, we didn't see this happen. You know, we didn't see all the suffering and loss, except some of us did. If you worked in hospitals and emergency rooms and saw the harm done by this day after day, I would appreciate it if you'd be willing to share how you tried to cope with that, how you wrapped your mind around it. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about the million lives lost in the U.S. because of COVID-19. We crossed that milestone officially anyway last week, and how to understand the level of loss, the pain and suffering that comes with that. Eric Boynton of Beloit College, philosopher there, stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experience with loss during the pandemic. Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Brian is with us in Appleton. Brian, hi.
Hi. I'm a healthcare worker, and I know there was a better possible outcome for this thing. Day after day, I can't tell you how many patients that I would see in primary care that were going to listen to their Fox News more than they would listen to their physician. And inevitably, it would come true, and then even after the fact, they would still not believe it. And I think it's appalling that the politicians in the area here were willing to risk their constituents' health in order to rally the troops as opposed to do the right thing. That's all I had to say.
Well, Brian, can I ask before you go? I know some healthcare workers were driven out of the field because of some of what you just mentioned. Are you still in there doing the job?
Well, I'm sundowning because of retirement, but otherwise, yes.
Okay. Brian, thank you so much for sharing that story. Eric, Brian brings up something else maybe unique about the pandemic and how we deal with it. The divisiveness, the politics that came up around it, and a lot of the misinformation that attached to that. How does that affect things?
Yeah, I do think there's a way in which the pandemic, of course, every kind of mass event like this, suffering on a mass scale, has ripple effects. It ripples through families, it ripples through communities. But I think this is exactly right, that this pandemic also has effects or ripple effects that exacerbate the issues that the pandemic has inflicted on us as a community and brought to the fore what was already there in terms of divisiveness, which I think, frankly, adds to the feeling that I talked about before, this basic malaise that kind of hangs over the pandemic, is that as a nation, we can't rally around a single interpretation or understanding of what it is that's happened. And that's actually something that memorialization or commemoration attempts to do, is to draw together a variety of different approaches into more or less a single trajectory. And it might be difficult in the near term to really come to terms with what happens because of the divisiveness itself. And so if there's a way in which the people on the front lines giving aid to those who are suffering are not only impinged by the disease and what they see all around them, but also the ways in which their work is not being valued, I think that's a ripple effect from what it is that we're experiencing on this kind of mass scale.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Eric, I've seen people throughout the course of this talk about the concept of psychic numbing, and it comes up again with, you know, the latest horrific mass shooting as well. This idea that we see it so much and we desensitize to it, but maybe there's an upside there too, because you can't live constantly meditating on the horror of loss from COVID and the pandemic. How do we find a middle ground, if that's such a thing?
Right. No, this is difficult. And this is, we can look at the events in Texas, at the pandemic. I mean, the world is replete. I mean, we can look in different regions around the world currently, Ukraine, for instance, or, current health disparities in the United States, for instance. All those things will lead to, what I've heard as a kind of fatigue, right? A numbness, sometimes referred as compassion fatigue. There is a need, I think, to turn off, in order that those kinds of events aren't crushing for everyone. But that can only go so far, because the reason why you're desensitizing, or the reason why you're turning your back on those things, is because they're so pressing. It's because they ought not be. It's because we have to apply ourselves to those constant pressures that are tearing us down and tearing down our world. And so there's no ability not to pay attention. And because of that, we find ourselves worn out, fatigued. So I think it's a kind of a balancing act. There's going to be a shift, but the fact is that we find ourselves fatigued is pointing to the phenomenon that we cannot properly live in a world that has these kinds of events in it, that we have to do something, whether it's taking charge and working on overcoming the conditions that allow those events to take place, or desensitizing. Either one of those things is in itself a kind of reaction. One of the ways in which we can find ourselves better able to attend to the suffering all around us is not always to think about empathy, the ways in which I have to imagine someone else's suffering in order to understand what's going on. But there's a way in which allowing our own suffering to do its work, and that actually opens us up to the suffering of others. And so there's a way in which a community community who comes together around what it is that's happening to us collectively is maybe a one approach to get at this problem of fatigue.
One thing I'd wanted to ask about before we run out of time, Eric, is I've talked to people who've done projects, including an online project called Who We Lost, giving like a little personal window into people who have been lost. And we see in the coverage of children lost this week in Texas, telling us some, not just them, about one of the number of people killed, but something about them individually. How important is to have that, I guess, that personal image of people we've lost, as opposed to the statistic of people we lost?
No, I think that's vitally important, that you have to do all of those things. So one example of that is if you take the Vietnam War Memorial, which when you stand back is this dark cut into the earth. But when you come close, it's the stones upon which individual names are cast. And then, interesting enough, your reflection is in the stone itself. And so the Vietnam War Memorial, I think, has that doubleness to it, is both the individual names and also the weight or the size of the loss. in the number of memorials in Germany and Poland, there is the Book of Life, which is the documentation of all the Jewish people who were lost to the Holocaust. And each individual name is listed there. But in addition, and this is also in Israel, but in addition, you see the mass of pages hanging before you. It's the largest book you've ever seen. So that kind of combination of both individual human loss on a very private scale and the ways in which that loss has deep and profound effects for the people around that person, and at the same time, seeing the multiplication of each one of those deaths on this mass scale. I think that in combination is what needs to be accomplished.
Briefly, Eric, we just have a minute left. Do you see efforts? Are we doing enough to try to memorialize the individuals and the mass of people lost during the pandemic?
Oh, I think we're in the thick of it. I don't think I've seen a good one. The New York Times has attempted to do this a couple of times. I think that proper memorialization comes with some time, the ability to look backwards a bit and think about what it is that, as best we can, the ways in which we can begin to point or gesture to what it is that's occurred to us as a collective people. So I think it's probably too soon, Rob, to take a stab at that. I do think there's probably people who are thinking about what a memorial will look like. The thing is that the memorial in this nation might be different than a memorial in another nation, and there might be some desire for a global reckoning as well, but I don't know what that would be yet.
Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I appreciate it.
That's Eric Boynton, philosopher who studied trauma and how societies remember it. He's provost and dean of Beloit College. He was with us today to talk about lives lost to COVID-19. As of last week, the U.S. death toll crossed 1 million and how we comprehend loss on that scale. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, having fun is a seriously important part of life. That's according to the author of the new book, The Power of Fun, How to Feel Alive Again. Find out more tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. When schools shifted back to in-person learning last school year, many families were relieved to have their kids back in classrooms, but for some, virtual learning really worked well. As Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin districts responded by creating or expanding virtual schooling that they expect will last even after the pandemic is over.
LB is a second grader at the Racine School District's virtual program. She goes by LB at school, and her family asked not to use her last name out of privacy concerns. She initially went virtual because her younger brother is at higher risk for COVID-19, but the family found that she's thriving in virtual school.
I love it because virtual is like my friend.
Racine had a virtual learning program before the pandemic, but it was mostly used in special cases. Students with medical issues who would miss too much school in person, or athletes and performers who traveled a lot and needed to keep up with schoolwork. Now, there are 660 students enrolled virtually full-time in grades K through 12, more than triple last year's enrollment. They have regular classes as well as gym, music, and art online.
I just like to make noise.
The school sent home kits for students to participate in music class. LB is thriving virtually, but that wasn't a common experience when most students had to learn virtually in the early pandemic. Students without regular internet access struggled to connect. Older students sometimes had to help their younger siblings through lessons, which meant their own studies fell by the wayside. And many just don't feel engaged when they're learning through a screen. But it was ideal for some. For students on the autism spectrum, it can be reassuring to have the distance and control of learning through a screen instead of the overstimulation of a classroom setting. Separation from a classroom also often works better for kids who are being bullied.
I think of one of our families who the son has an IEP.
TJ McCray is in charge of Madison Promise, the district's new virtual program. An IEP, or an individualized education plan, is a plan for students with special needs.
During pandemic, the student really excelled. Mom got them on a virtual program, and we're really seeing some progress with that student.
While Racine had an existing program it could modify, modify, Madison Promise is a new virtual program started this school year. Milwaukee and Green Bay created similar programs.
We were all afraid that we would be recognized as being like the COVID school, and that was never the intention.
Tanya Sioni teaches third grade in Green Bay's virtual program.
The intention was that people were coming here because it's what they needed for their lifestyle, or because it was a choice that they were making, not something that they felt like they had to do because they had no other choices.
She says that while some students did go back once they got vaccinated, a lot are planning to return to virtual next school year for reasons that have nothing to do with COVID. The Green Bay School District even built classrooms for virtual teachers that are outfitted with cameras, microphones, and other tools to make it easier to teach. Madison Promise has a timeline to add more classrooms for different ages. Virtual charter schools, which handled most of the state's online learners before the pandemic, have grown, and 9 new ones have opened in Wisconsin in the past 2 years. A 2021 survey by the RAND Corporation found that about 11% of families didn't want to send their kids back in person, but the survey was done before vaccines were available for kids under 12. All 7 of Deborah White's kids are learning virtually this year.
We tend to get sick, not all together, but one at a time. So I just feel like it was the most convenient thing for my family at the time because we have so many small people in the house.
But they mostly want to return in person, like Taylor, age 9.
When I do virtual, I don't be focused. But when I do in person, I be totally focused.
Virtual learning wasn't optional for many schools in the first year or more of the pandemic, but enough students found that it worked well for them that they want to stick with it, and schools are responding by building new programs for them. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, closing arguments are scheduled tomorrow in a case that's gotten a lot of attention in a wide variety of both news outlets and social media platforms. Actor Johnny Depp sued his ex-wife, actor Amber Heard, for defamation. The lawsuit is based on a 2018 opinion piece she wrote for The Washington Post about being a survivor of domestic abuse. Depp argued that while the piece didn't name him specifically, it still caused damage to his reputation and career. Regardless of the outcome, some experts on sexual and domestic violence are worried about the effects it could have on victims of abuse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this week's long trial, avoiding it, or seeing news about it even if you were trying to avoid it? What has stood out to you about the coverage? If you have dealt with issues of domestic violence in your own life, what does this all say to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Nicole Badera is a sociologist who focuses on gender-based violence. She recently completed her PhD at the University of Michigan, where she studied college sexual assault. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Before we get into specific, takeaways from this trial that you might be worried about, this is a really a weird thing. We're like nationwide, worldwide, people are watching this case unfold in real time, picking sides, doing things on social media and TikTok to support one person in this or another. It seems like it'd be hard to get a good message out of this sort of media circus approach. What do you think about that?
Yeah, this has been a really unusual case because of the amount of attention it has gotten and what attention that has been. So usually if we know a case is going to be high profile, you'll see coverage in big mainstream media platforms like NPR or the New York Times or places like that. But this case at the beginning was treated like more of a celebrity tabloid issue. And the people who originally took up the helm to discuss it were people like TikTok influencers or podcasters that stream to YouTube. And these people didn't necessarily have a lot of expertise on the subject of gender-based violence. And as a result, there's been a lot of misinformation spreading about the trial and about how to make sense of intimate partner violence in general.
And what are some of your biggest worries when it comes to misleading messages people could get, especially when it comes to intimate partner violence?
There's already a lot of misinformation about intimate partner violence, and it has a lot of really predictable outcomes. One that's very alarming is that when we dismiss survivors' true stories of intimate partner violence and we scrutinize and criticize them, it can be more difficult for victims who are currently in violent relationships to see the violence they're experiencing as wrong. And so they might stay longer if they identify with Amber Heard's story and they start to think to themselves, is what I'm going through really that bad? So that's one obvious one. Another one is that when survivors do come forward, their friends and family might be more likely to victim blame them. They might be more likely to question whether there was really abuse, and that can be harmful too. And then something unique about this particular case is that Amber Heard did not name a perpetrator when she identified as a survivor. And that can lead a lot of survivors to wonder, will I face a defamation case if I advocate for sexual violence or intimate partner violence? Could I be the one who's going to face this kind of punishment next?
That's something I've seen as a concern, that defamation cases, whether they're successful or not, could be used as a tactic to prevent victims of intimate partner violence from coming forward. Is this a concern, or do you think this is something that's going to be unique to this particular high profile case?
It is a concern, in part because we already know that it's not unique. So my background is mostly in campus sexual violence. And in that setting, 23% of survivors that report to their universities face the threat of a defamation lawsuit from their perpetrators. Now, I want to say it doesn't matter if those defamation lawsuits are successful. It doesn't matter if the victim would ultimately win in the end. They're still expensive and they're scary. And one thing that we should always keep in mind is they do force prolonged contact between victim and perpetrator. So in this case, for example, Amber Heard left her relationship with Johnny Depp years ago. She left in 2016, and now they've had to spend 6 weeks next to each other every day in the same courtroom. So in that way, these defamation cases, regardless of their outcome, can become an extension of a perpetrator's abuse. And then when you add the social media frenzy in this kind of a high-profile case, then they can be used to punish, harass, and humiliate victims too.
In the social media frenzy that you mentioned, a lot of the detailed fine point sorts of things seem to be people analyzing Amber Heard's demeanor, performance, how she's presenting herself, and trying to read and glean from that if her accusations of domestic violence are authentic or not. This idea of somebody having to be in some ways the phrase is the perfect victim in a courtroom. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I think it's really striking that there is a lot of attention to these fine details. And that's sort of a trope in crime shows, including true crime shows. We love some kind of a crime drama that ends with that one piece of evidence that looked irrelevant cracking the case. But in reality, this type of irrelevant evidence can be really damaging, especially in gender-based violence trials where there is so much misinformation and so much misunderstanding about victims' behavior. So that's where we run into the problems of the perfect victim trope, where there's no such thing as a perfect victim. The whole point of this trope is that no victim can live up to it, that everyone will break the rules of how you should behave at some point. And that's because they're contradictory. This is actually what my very first study I ever conducted was about how all of the rules women are supposed to follow about how to be a victim and how to prevent violence contradict one another, which makes it impossible to fit into the stereotype. And so you see that on display with how Amber Heard is being criticized, that she's crying too much or she's not crying enough is a really good example of how her behavior is being picked apart, while Johnny Depp is not being held to the same standard.
We're talking to sociologist Nicole Badera about gender-based violence, her concerns about this high-profile Johnny Depp defamation suit against Amber Heard over her writing about being a domestic abuse survivor without naming him. That trial wrapping up this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following this story? How is it impacting you? Is it dredging up maybe personal experiences for you? Do you have questions about how these kind of cases are handled in the court? Are you worried about the social mediaization, if I can make that word up, and how it affects what we're learning or think we're learning from this trial? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the defamation trial involving actors and former spouses Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Central to this, accusations of domestic abuse, intimate partner violence. Even if you haven't wanted to follow this case, it is getting a lot of coverage, coverage on social media in particular. Sociologist Nicole Badera is our guest. We're talking about the impacts this high-profile trial could have on abusers and on victims of gender-based violence. You can join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Nicole, I've seen concerns out there that some people are actively promoting this on social media with particular messages, trying to call claims of domestic abuse into question in the first place. Is that a concern you have?
Yeah, it's something that we've seen a lot. Some of the most popular hashtags that have been dominating the social media discussion have been questioning what domestic abuse even is and whether or not it's fair for women to say that they've experienced domestic abuse. And I want to point out that a lot of the social media response has just been really misogynist. That if you look at the types of ways that Amber Heard is being talked about, the language isn't very kind, to say the least. And it's based off of these old tropes that women who make allegations of intimate partner violence are liars or psychopaths. And so it's really important that when you do see these gendered tropes come up, that you give them a little bit more thought and you start to think, how is gender inequality shaping this broader conversation?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call and thanks for this conversation. I think it's really informative to learn about these things. My comment is kind of two parts. One, just reflecting the social media aspect, I frequent Reddit, and the number of references that I've seen, it's really disappointing to see how quick people are to disbelieve or disparage things that Amber Heard says or does, and how quick they are to just blindly accept things that Johnny Depp has said, and it's just been disappointingly one-sided. The other thing I was going to say, and I'll make this short, the professor, you had mentioned something about contradictory standards that women are expected to conform to. And in a recent course that I took, Women in Literature, you can look back, hundreds of years at things women have wrote and see that these sorts of contradictory standards that are at odds with each other and are punishing to women and their freedom and their expression have been around for way too long. And this is just kind of one new way that you see that.
Michael, thanks for the call. Nicole, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're picking up on something that has happened for a very long time. And part of what's disappointing in this moment is we thought that the Me Too movement would have helped protect against some of these myths. But I think one of the reasons that these double standards are persisting is because of who the original audience for this case was. It blew up on TikTok. And so if you think about who in your own family is the most likely to be on TikTok, I know in mine, it's some of the teenagers who are actually too young to really be aware of the Me Too movement at its peak. And so one thing the Me Too movement did not successfully do was promote a lot of structural changes, including instilling education on what intimate partner violence is and how to support victims into our formal education systems. So a lot of people who are seeing this stuff, they don't know any better still. And we really, one thing we can take away from this case is how important it is to create structural change to make sure that everybody is getting the information about how to recognize violence when it's happening and how to support victims when it does.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Susan next in Rhinelander. Susan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to offer that I took in a few snippets of the coverage, and I immediately had a sense that not only did it seem very tragic on both sides, but that it was an invasion of privacy. It almost felt unseemly for me to watch it. So that was enough for me. But also, you're just looking at the, intrinsically, an older man with a much younger woman in the relationship. He comes into it with a lot of power and financial resources. And the little bit that I saw where he was testifying, it almost felt like that he was not taking it seriously, or that there was some almost a comic undertone. Hard to pinpoint, but that was my sense in just the little bit that I saw.
Well, Susan, I felt the same way in watching a little bit to prepare for the show today. It felt very voyeuristic to watch it in the first place. Nicole, does it do us any good to have this out there in the public? I know legally cameras can be in the courtroom there, but I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think it does. One of my big takeaways from this case is that we should increase protections for this type of a court case, because we know that predictably, when we have cases of gender-based violence that get this kind of scrutiny or a live stream, that it can lead to a lot of harassment of the victim. And there isn't a lot of protection in place to keep that from happening. In fact, this defamation case naming Amber Heard has led her to be quite defamed. And I'll say that I do agree, and I've heard a lot of people who've actually watched the case themselves say that that's kind of the impression they've gotten about Johnny Depp's behavior, that the coverage that's happening on social media is really disassociated from what's happening in the courtroom. And people who do watch some of it for themselves are really shocked to see what's going on.
Susan, thanks for the call. Tom joins us now in Brookfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to bring up the point that the inequality there is when it comes to cases like this, where Amber herself has admitted to hitting Johnny. And when Johnny is upset and cries, she makes fun of him and just degrades his manhood. It's a very one-sided argument, and I don't like how nobody pays attention to when the woman abuses the man, but everyone cares about it when it's the other way around.
Tom, thanks for the call. Nicole, Tom feels like there's a double standard for men and women when it comes to intimate partner abuse.
Yeah, I think that this is a really important point to be able to address, because this comes up a lot. Johnny Depp has made allegations that that Amber Heard was the true abuser. And the reality is that this is something that happens to victims of intimate partner violence a lot if they use violence as a form of self-defense, which when you think about it in any other context, if you're being violently attacked, you would expect someone to defend themselves. But this has led to a lot of confusion and misinformation around what intimate partner violence is and who the victims are. One thing I want everybody to take away from this case is that the context of violence matters. Whether or not someone is responding out of fear versus trying to control matters. And we have a lot of work to do on this. For example, in my own field of social science, we've made some mistakes in the past where we've used surveys to gauge who victims are in intimate partner violence relationships that were completely neutral and didn't take context into account. And so we would ask, has your partner hit you, for example? And when you do it that way, it actually looks like men are more likely to be victims than women. But that's because women are unlikely to say that they have been hit by a partner if they were acting in self-defense. And so you were capturing men who were claiming to be victims when they were both perpetrators and victims. And that's one of the complexities moving forward. Context is really important. There's a difference between aggression and self-defense.
Nicole, thanks for the call, Tom. In just our last minute, Nicole, what are you hoping that people can take away from a trial like this?
Something that I think is really crucial is that we do need to make more structural changes to support the Me Too movement. Since we haven't changed the legal system that so commonly betrays survivors, it's going to continue to do so. And so it's time for some serious reforms. And then the other thing that I think is most important is to make sure that we are protecting survivors' freedom of speech. It is so crucial that survivors can talk about what has happened to them.
Nicole, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Badera is a sociologist who studies gender-based violence. She's with us today to talk about some wider concerns she has coming out of the high-profile defamation trial involving actors and ex-spouses Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Resources out there. The National Domestic Violence Hotline phone number is 1-800-799-7233. That's 1-800-799-7233 for the National Domestic Violence Hotline. The National Dating Abuse Helpline number is 1-866-331-9474. Again, 866-331-9474, or you can text LOVEIS to 22522. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, another string of mass shootings is pointing attention back at gun laws as the NRA meets this weekend in Texas. We'll look at the latest in the politics of gun regulation. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.